working on American soil, Dan. Ain't had this much fun since Woodward and Bernstein.
How long can we keep this up?
Congress is pushing through some new bill that's gonna outlaw masks. Our days are numbered. Till then, it's like you always say, we're society's only protection.
From what?
Are you kidding me? From themselves. Son of a bitch.
No, comedian, wait!
Get your stinking hands off me.
What the hell happened to us? What happened to the American dream?
What happened to the American dream? It came true. You're looking at it.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a very special Epic Film Guys Spotlight talking about the 2009 Zack Snyder film Watchmen. I am, of course, Nick from the Epic Film Guys, and I am not alone in this endeavor. I am joined by a Lisp lover, a high-level patron of the Epic Film Guys podcast who chose this spotlight and really wanted to do this. So, Dan from Netflix and Swill is joining me today. How the hell are you, Dan?
I really don't like being labeled as a Lisp lover, but I'm fine. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Listen, that's what you get for pledging at that level. You are...
Well, looks like I'm removing that level.
So, we're here to talk about the 2009 Zack Snyder film Watchmen. And before we get into that, Dan, there's a little something that we love to do every week on the main show of the Epic Film Guys. And, of course, I'm talking about what are you drinking?
I'm just back. Puke and rally.
And being here the guest on the stream today, welcome everyone that is watching us over on the live stream today. Dan, what are you drinking?
I'm almost at like not even guest status anymore because I'm just like almost always on your show.
That is very true.
I am currently drinking Hail to the Hop Thief Double IPA from Stone Brewing Company. It is 9.8 alcohol by volume, and I can't find... Oh, wait. No. Come on. Untapped. Yeah. 80 IBUs. There. So all the flavor profiles you'll ever need in making your beer decisions.
Hooray.
It's good.
That's actually a fantastic beer. I've had it several times. So great choice. Great, great, great choice. I am drinking. You were supposed to be drinking this, too, because you told me you had a four-pack of it. I am drinking New Holland Brewing's Dragon's Milk. It's a bourbon barrel-aged stout. I've had it before, so we won't wax on and on and on about how much we love it or anything like that. Because, Dan, we're here to talk Watchmen.
who watches the Watchmen? Well, us, clearly.
Yes. All right, and I wanted to kick things off by first things first, Dan. Have you read the graphic novel on which this is based by Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons?
Indeed, I have read some parts of the graphic novel. I own it, but currently my dad is borrowing it, and by borrowing it, I mean like he's been on the same page for like the last like 9 months, so.
Way to go, Dan's dad.
I mean, he's a lover of comic books, so it's one of those that you kind of have to have.
He's a lover of comic books, but not enough to actually read it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I, of course, have also read the graphic novel. It actually was the first trailer for this film that came out that prompted me to buy it, because I'd never heard of it before, and I just thought visually it looked so cool. I basically kind of ran right out and bought it after that. I finally just got these new XLR cables. You can't see it on the camera here, but I got a nice brand new XLR cable plugged into my microphone, which means...
Don't say fuck! Don't say fuck! Don't say fuck!
The soundboard is back. Unfortunately, in the last episode of the Epic Film Guys, did not have it. All right, but Dan, I want to open this up. You were on for our Batman versus Superman spotlight as well, so you're kind of familiar with how this goes. Yes. Yes.
Yes.
So, basically, I just want to kick it over to you. Are there any things you want to kind of open up on with this film?
Yeah, so, a lot of people... Like, Zack Snyder is a very divisive director. Like, you're either a lover of Zack Snyder or you're a hater of Zack Snyder. That said, I'm probably like in that camp that likes Zack Snyder. I don't love him. Like I feel like there's certain things that he kind of struggles with, specifically with pacing, and fitting his entire vision of a story into a cohesive 2.5 hours or 2 hours or whatever. I've noticed that, especially with watching the Ultimate Cut, like a bit of the Ultimate Cut. I watched the theatrical cut earlier today on HBO, and then I started watching the Ultimate Cut, and then just realized how much more story is packed into this the Ultimate Cut. And I'm just like, and I'm thinking to myself, like, what is it with Zack Snyder in particular that he's a director that has so much story, but just like can't figure out how to parse it all out and, you know, try to make it more cohesive into like a theatrical route than he has? Because, like, as you said with Batman vs. Superman, if you compare the theatrical cut to the director's cut, it's like night and day. Like, they're two completely separate movies. These are closer. The Ultimate Cut and the theatrical cut, they're closer in quality, which is still very good. But there's still story bits that are missing from the theatrical cut that help make the movie feel more cohesive.
Yeah, and I can't disagree with you there. There's a lot of stuff that they eviscerated in the theatrical cut of this film that really, I mean, there's just so much in this film to digest, really. The Ultimate Cut is the one with the Black Freighter stuff that was kind of integrated into it, right?
Yeah. Which I don't care about.
It's fine. And I like the Black Freighter thing that they did. They animated it. They had Gerard Butler do the voice of the pirate and everything. And that whole story is kind of supposed to parallel Adrian's character arc. But considering they eviscerated the character of Ozymandias in this film, like, so much from the graphic novel, it's almost like it doesn't even belong. So I watched the director's cut when I watched this film again. I didn't bother with the ultimate cut because, as great as that Black Freighter stuff is, I just feel like integrating it just doesn't really fit. But yeah, I would agree with you on that regard, that Zack Snyder has a hard time parsing things down and getting them into a digestible theatrical runtime. But outside of Batman versus Superman, I think this story especially, there's way too much going on in this story, and there's way too much to know about this world and about these characters, where I, honest to God, think that it was too short in a way. You know, I feel like it purposely cuts out certain characters. You don't get character backstory bits that you kind of need, and I feel like that's a disservice to it. So I would almost argue that it's too short. Almost.
Well, sure. But, like, and I hate to keep, like, going back to this, but, like, we saw with, like, Blade Runner 2049, it's a 2-hour-and-51-minute movie that I don't want to say bombed at the box office, but it didn't do very well.
Oh, it did. It's losing, like, $80 million.
Right. So, I guess it does bomb by that definition. But, like, the movie is so long that I feel like it's something, like, you go to a movie for like 2-2.5 hours and you're like, all right, yeah. But once you start encroaching upon 3, that's when you start really seeing, you know, problems where it's like, I don't think you can have somebody's attention for all that long. So as much as I wanted, and I feel that the ultimate cut is superior, with the exception of like the Black Freighter, because it's just such a big, deep tonal shift that it doesn't, like, to me, it doesn't really matter. Like, I understand what its purpose is, but I don't feel like it's all that, it's like necessary. And so I'm kind of glad it got cut from the theatrical cut. But I don't know. There are certain things that needed to be included. Like, there are certain backstories to the comedian. Like, because, like, sure, in the theatrical cut, we get it. The comedian's a giant piece of shit. But you start, like, with the director's cut and the ultimate cut, you start to see a little bit more of why he's a piece of shit.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. I don't disagree with that at all. And I think this material, having read the graphic novel, like, once I saw the trailer and I read the graphic novel, I was like, how in the hell are they going to fit this into one film? Mm-hmm. And I really think, like, it became fashionable, like, maybe right around this time or maybe like a little bit after this time, to take films and then cut them into two halves. So that way you could, quote unquote, tell more story And of course, it's for Hollywood. It's make more money. But I really feel like this is something that could have benefited from a part one and a part two, where I don't know where you make the breaking off point in the middle, but
as Rorschach gets arrested.
Yep. You could have the scene where he gets arrested. But even still, like, if they would have done that, they could have fit the requisite backstory into this film. They really, really could have, because characters like Adrian and even characters like Laurie, especially in the theatrical cut, she gets butchered in the theatrical. Mm-hmm. She's a little better in the director's cut, but not much. And I mean, the less of you of Laurie's character that you get in the film, as far as I'm concerned, is fine, because that's less Malin Ackerman that you have to put up with, because I hate her performance in this film. It's terrible. And there's so many great performances. There's so many great things about this film that she is so glaringly awful by comparison.
Yeah, that's very true. Like, I you mentioned that in one of our personal chats that we have, and I just went, well, who's that? And then I Googled it, and then I was like, oh, she's Laurie. Okay. And then I actually watched, and I'm like, yeah, she is pretty terrible in comparison to people like Patrick Wilson and Jackie Earle Haley and Jeffrey Dean Morgan. What is it with people with their three names in this movie?
I think she's like way worse than Matthew Good. I think she's way worse than pretty much anyone or anything in this film. She is head and shoulders above like the worst parts of it. And that's one of the things I think that when you watch it, every time she shows up on screen, it really is like, but it's such an important character because she was fathered by the comedian, so she has to be in here. And I just think, especially in the theatrical cut, they butchered that. So I think if you take this film and you turn it into a two-parter, then it would have allowed this expansiveness where you could have explored her character fully. You could have gotten more of the character bits of Dr. Manhattan that I think this film is missing, and you could have spent a lot more time on Adrian Veidt. I think that unfortunately, the villain, I mean, in superhero movie 101 nowadays, the villain gets the shit under the stick. And in this film, he really does. But in a story like Watchmen that ends the way it does, with the villain basically, you know, succeeding in a way, I think it's criminal to eviscerate the villain's character arc the way that they did.
Well, yeah, because, like, let's remember here. Whenever Veidt fights the would-be assassin at his headquarters, we pretty much don't see the character again until Antarctica, which is the quote-unquote final act of the movie, when it's like the last 30 minutes or like 20 minutes or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, so you can't, like, you see this from time to time where in superhero movies, the villain will just disappear from the screen for 40, 50, maybe even an hour worth of time. Like, you can't be doing that to somebody who's supposed to be this badass, or like who is supposed to be your main antagonist. Like, you can't say to this person, you can't say about this character, hey, your character arc doesn't matter, so we're gonna focus on the people that are the quote unquote heroes of the movie. Which to me, there are almost no heroes to this movie. Especially at the end, I think actually like the last remaining hero is Rorschach because of how he feels about the whole sacrifice of humanity. But focusing on everybody but Adrian really, I guess it really just was off-putting, because it was like, you're like, up until the reveal of him as the villain, you're just kind of like, yeah, I guess he's just like a bit character. And then all of a sudden, there he is, the villain, and he's the villain. And you're just like, well, where the fuck did this come from?
And I think that's one of the problems with this film. The way that Watchmen is structured, especially in the graphic novel, it's very much like the film. I mean, in terms of adaptations from graphic novel to film, I mean, a lot of this stuff is like panel to shot. So many things are so perfectly captured here. And the plot of who killed the comedian unfortunately finds its way into the background a lot of times as you're exploring the other characters, to where it isn't necessarily the most important part of the story. And then so when you finally get back to it, you're like, oh, right, this is the thing we're supposed to care about or supposed to be paying attention to. And I think that cutting out Veidt's character arc, because a lot of it is really important in understanding who he is and where he's coming from, I think that when you cut that out of the film, you cut out even more attention that should be paid to the whole I'm going to kill millions to save billions kind of thing. It's right. It's a huge disservice to the story because, I mean, it's like you said, and even thinking of that scene where the assassin attacks him, when do you see him in the film before that? Like, it's a long gap between that and the time you saw him before that, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like every other character gets these long, long pieces of backstory, really focused on them. The comedian gets tons of backstory. Manhattan gets tons of backstory. Night Owl 2 even gets tons of it. And then.
Well, I think if you want to like if you want to go analytical on it, I think the way you can say for the movie that the reason why Veidt isn't. Like doesn't get all this backstory is that this character feels like he's too important for what the Watchmen are now. So having him just kind of being like this tangential character until the very end makes sense in that his machinations are too high level for everybody else. Like for instance, like Rorschach, all he's doing is investigating the murder of the comedian, but with Veidt, all he's trying to do is look at the bigger picture, which is potentially solving an energy crisis, helping stop a nuclear war, a Holocaust, and like. So I guess in the scope of the movie, if you think about it like that, it makes sense why, you know, because he's just too high level for everything that we don't get him featured enough. But still, I don't feel like that excuses the fact that he's like. Very sparingly in the movie.
I think we've talked more about Adrian Veidt in this spotlight than he is focused on in the entire film.
I think
which
you're
is sad. And I mean, to think about the ultimate cut for a moment with the Black Freighter stuff in there, the Black Freighter stuff is really meant to complement Ozymandias' character arc because it is a metaphor ultimately for the way he ends up feeling about humanity and his plan to, quote, save it. You know, so all that stuff being missing from the actual film, I think if you would have gone for a two-part, you know, maybe even if each of them was 2.5 hours long, I really, really think that you could have packed in a ton of the story of this film and just not even had an issue. But I want to move on from Veidt, and I want to move on to a lot of the stuff that worked in this film, because I still love this film. And I think you love this film, and I think we have to talk about the reasons why. And first and foremost, for me on that list, and for a lot of people, let's be honest, has to be Jackie Earle Haley as Rorschach. Like, there are actors in this film, and there are character portrayals that they do that are so picture perfect that it's damn near impossible to not just, like, drool over them when they're on the screen.
Mm-hmm. So when I first watched this movie, I had no idea about I mean, I knew there was a graphic novel called Watchmen.
Yeah.
But like, I had never read it at that point. So Jackie Earle Haley was just like this, had this visceral portrayal of this really messed up kid who had, I don't want to say delusions of grandeur, but like had this ideal of what a hero could be based off of what he'd seen when he was younger. Whether that be from the Watchmen previously or what he felt like he could do and what he wanted to do to help people.
Yeah.
Which in the ultimate cut, I guess it's the psychiatric evaluation where he's sitting in the room with a doctor and he's just like, you know, once you see the underbelly of crime, you can't just ignore that. You can't just walk away.
Yeah.
And that's how we feel. They referenced the Keen Act, I think that's what it was called, consistently, which banned costume heroes and masked heroes. But like for people like Rorschach who can't stop, you know, that's not a deterrent for him. He'll keep going, whether that means he stays in prison or not. And that's, he actually mentions that too, where he's just like, he's talking to Daniel, and Daniel's like, "How you been, Rorschach?" And Rorschach just says, "Fine, keeping out of prison." Like that's it. You know, it's that character. And I want to dive into it a little bit later about the dichotomy between Night Owl and Rorschach, but that character is very Batman-esque for me.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. And I mean, just kind of the darkness that character has within him. I mean, of course, he has a horrific upbringing. You get to see it in the opening montage there, where his mom is essentially a whore. And I think it's fantastic the way that he is kind of a black and white character, and it's perfectly personified by the Rorschach mask, where it's just black blobs moving around on a white canvas, because this character has no gray. It's either justice or evil. You know, it's either good or bad. It's either, you know, black or white. And I love that character sensibility, because he's the only real character in the film that has that mindset, that has that kind of feeling, where it's, you know, if he sees something that's this way, he has to act and he has to do something about it. And I love that about him. And Jackie Earl Haley absolutely knocks it out of the park. Just
absolutely
completely nails every single aspect of that character. There are certain characters translated from screen to page where you read the graphic novel and you kind of envision them a certain way. And when you first kind of read the graphic novel and you see all that stuff and you kind of get an idea of Rorschach's personality, exactly the way I imagined it, exactly as I pictured it. And he gives that great monologue you're talking about, when he talks about the moment where Walter Kovacs kind of died forever and it was just Rorschach. I think that's such a picture perfect scene, because he's faced with the most gruesome and the most horrific of realities. And you understand this character because he talks about, you know, fate didn't butcher that girl, you know, and everything. God doesn't make the world the way it is. We do, you know, and oh man, it's so fantastic. What a fantastic character and what a fantastic portrayal he has.
Well, and I like to compare Rorschach to Batman because of the way he feels. Like, specifically, a lot of the times, especially when he's getting arrested, and they're trying to pull off the Rorschach mask, he's screaming, "Don't touch my face! Just don't touch my face!"
Yeah.
Or when he's in the prison and he runs into the doctor and he says, "Give me back my face!"
Yep.
Well, that's Rorschach is him. It's like Batman. Like, there are Batman arcs where I believe it's the first time the DC Trinity met together, and Wonder Woman presents them all with like the lasso of truth, and they all grab onto it, and she says to identify, for each person to identify themselves, and Diana identifies herself, Superman identifies himself as Clark Kent, and Batman introduces himself like identifies himself as Batman. And there's another thing where in Batman Beyond, Bruce Wayne, his mind's getting fucked with, and they're like, the new Batman's like, "Hey, how did you know that, you know, this wasn't real?" And he's like, "Well, the Vision was calling me Bruce. And in my own mind, I don't call myself Bruce." And it's heavily implied from there that he means he calls himself Batman. But that's to me, that's the side of Rorschach that we get, is like that kind of Batman, who is just so vigilant, so dutiful, even though he is far more brutal than some of the Batmans we've seen in the past. Yeah. Although Batman versus Superman, Batman might have something to say about that.
Maybe. Well, it's kind of a perfect segue as well to move from there to talk about Patrick Wilson as Night Owl too, because he's very much meant to be kind of a representation of Batman, where he's got, you know, the millions and millions of dollars that he inherited and he used it to buy all these gadgets and fund this whole crime fighting empire. What were your thoughts of Wilson in the film?
Wilson probably has the most complex character. You know, when you look at Dr. Manhattan and you look at Rorschach, they kind of have this singular character arc. Like, Manhattan is always about the logical thing, and Rorschach is always about doing the quote-unquote right thing, even if the means are incorrect. With Patrick Wilson, he... and the Night Owl character, he... like, when the Keen Act comes out, he's one of the first to say, okay, I can stop, and I will stop, and I'll just put this all down, and I will become a normal person. Excuse me. And then, at the end, when it's revealed that Ozymandias has decided to kill all of the people, like 15 million people? Something like that?
Something like that, yeah.
So like, whenever that's revealed, you know, he gets angry, but then he also comes to understand what the whole thought is behind that. And it's like... he kind of toes the line always between, like, what's right and what's wrong. And for him, like, he sees the greater good in like, stopping the masked heroes and, you know, the murder of 15 million people. He sees the good in that. But, you know, as an audience, you feel like Rorschach is still the moral compass, despite the fact that, he brutalizes people. And you kind of feel the way Rorschach thinks is the correct way, and that everyone should be thinking like this. And we see how that winds up for Rorschach. But with Patrick Wilson, it's almost like he's too afraid to do the right thing if that means he's going to, you know, either A, get in trouble, or B, be killed for not following the new convention, the new norm.
Yeah, and the best thing about Wilson's performance is the way that he is torn between just his normal kind of existence as Dan Dreiberg and his existence as the Night Owl. And the greatest thing about it is that he does have that brutality to him. Like, mm-hmm. Especially in the director's cut after the death of Hollis Mason, which was something that was hugely omitted from the theatrical. I still remember that back in the day. But, you know, he sees the Knot Top, the gang member at the bar, and, like, literally just mangles his face because he beats him so hard. Like, mm-hmm. It's almost like, I mean, you see Rorschach kill people, like, here and there, left and right. But, like, that scene with Dreiberg feels worse because Dreiberg feels more like a normal person than does Rorschach, or than does a lot of the different characters in this film. So you almost kind of put yourself in his shoes as a vehicle to walk through this film. Mm-hmm. And that scene, like, it's hard not to feel for that character, and it's hard not to almost see yourself in that place, you know what I mean? Where he,
yeah,
like, literally brutalizes that dude just because Hollis Mason got killed. And, mm-hmm. You know, I think that's the greatest thing about Dreiberg's character, is because, A, he lies to himself. He denies how much he needs Night Owl and how much he needs to be Night Owl and how much it defined his life, while, you know, you're exactly right. He is able to say, when the Keen Act comes along and he's like, oh, I give up, I'm walking away from this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have that aspect of it, and you have the character that's able to see the greater good in things. And that's why I love that character, is because that's Night Owl. Night Owl, you need to have that character transition in him to where he turns his back on all that kind of stuff, and he kind of ignores all that stuff until he puts the suit back on. I love the idea that, you know, he has to come to terms with and accept the fact that he needs Night Owl. Like, he needs to be out there saving people, and he needs to be out there helping people. And I love that, you know, he's... It basically, it's his, like, superhero Viagra, almost, to where he, like, literally, he...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Like, he hates himself as Dreiberg, in a way. He really, really does. He hates himself as Dreiberg, because who is he as Dreiberg? Like, he's nobody. He's just some balding dude, some fat dude who just like goes and hangs out with an old guy once a week and drinks beer. That's literally the only thing that defines his life. But in the Night Owl suit, like, he can live in that world where he helps people, where he does everything for people and lives for other people. And that's, I think that that transformation is why he's able to see the better good, the greater good, as you said, in Adrian's plan.
You kind of brought it up with it whenever he puts on the Night Owl suit. We don't actually see him in the Night Owl suit until almost like the end of the second act, really. When he and the Silk Spectre 2 go out in Archimedes and go save those people from the fire, that's the first time we actually see him in the suit. I mean, outside of, you know, flashbacks.
Yeah,
and that
one
kind of
brief
stuff,
but flashback with the comedian earlier in the film, yeah. Which is that's very much the comedian's flashback, not his. So
well, right, because during that part, it's flashing through all the characters and like a moment they had with the comedian that kind of defined their relationship with the comedian.
And I mean, speaking of the comedian, I actually want to kind of start talking about the comedian now, because, oh God, I'm so torn on favorite characters in this film. I'm so torn on Jeffrey Dean Morgan as the comedian or Dr. Manhattan. Like, it, for me, it's, I could go one way one day and I can go one way the next day. But, you know, speaking of the comedian, I mean, number one, Jeffrey Dean Morgan is perfect. Is literally note perfect as this character. And yeah, his relationship with all these characters is essential to the central conceit of the film, which is Rorschach's whole mass killer theory, which of course it doesn't have anything to do with just trying to kill masks. It's because he stumbles upon Ozymandias's plan. Like, he figures out Ozymandias's plan way before anybody else does, and that's why he has that great scene with Moloch where he's breaking down and he's crying because he, like, Rorschach kind of says it perfectly at one point, that the comedian's just a parody of the awful aspects of humanity.
Yeah,
and I think that that's a fantastic description of that character, because he just realizes that mankind is doomed. He realizes that no matter what they do, mankind is just kind of screwed anyway, but he still kind of plays along with everything, and he still kind of, you know, puts himself into this system where he's the superhero, and especially in the Minutemen stage early on, he's saving people. And then, the Night Owl scene, speaking of that great flashback that he has with Night Owl, you know, when the people are rioting because the police are on strike, you know, he jumps down off of the thing and he just starts beating the shit out of people, and he's firing the beanbags into the crowd and he's firing fucking gas grenades at people.
Yeah.
Like, this is a character that just, I love the kind of the inherent nihilism in that character and the inherent kind of darkness in that character. Like, Rorschach's a dark character, comedian, way fucking darker, in my opinion.
Well, right, because while Rorschach will maim criminals and people who he feels are criminals, the comedian will fuck up anybody he can at any moment in time. You know, we see that in the bar in Vietnam when the pregnant woman comes to him and is like, "Hey, we need to talk about this child that I have, that it's your child," and he just shoots her because, you know, she like slashes his face. He rapes or attempts to rape the original Silk Spectre. He and you can almost see it in that Night Owl scene where he's kind of getting off from the fact that he is, you know, just brutalizing people that have no ability to fight back. Like sure, they can fight back, but he is just so much above their level that when they do fight back, it looks like a child trying to fight an adult.
And I think the best distinction between the comedian and between Rorschach is that the comedian doesn't give a fuck. The comedian just straight up doesn't give a fuck about right, about wrong, about good, about bad. He gives a fuck mostly about the comedian. And that's really the only thing that he ever strives toward, is just the comedian. You know, and you get to see this in all those different flashbacks. It's like you said, when he just straight up shoots the pregnant girl. Like, what's he pissed off about? She cut his face. So he just shoots a pregnant girl down in a bar. you know, and like, you know, they threw a beer can or something like that and hit him in the head when he was.
Yeah.
And he jumps down and he starts beating the shit out of people and shooting them with beanbags. You know, and I love so much of that character, and I love Jeffrey Dean Morgan's performance in that role. I think he's fantastic.
Well, and this really gets me excited for Flashpoint, the Flash movie. Continues to be Flashpoint.
Please God in heaven.
Oh, I'm so excited for that, because Flashpoint, despite my reservations with Flashpoint being the first Flash movie, I love that story and what it means.
Please,
so
God.
So seeing a very brutal Jeffrey Dean Morgan in this movie just kind of has me extremely hopeful for what that movie can be.
Just straight up beating the shit out of people and murdering people.
Oh, I just came a little.
Oh, I can't wait. But there's only one more main cast member that we haven't really talked about all that much yet, Dan, and that is Dr. Manhattan, who is played by Billy Crudup. And he's probably my favorite character in the graphic novel. I think the comedian probably edges him out in terms of in the film. And I've always gone back to it. It's seems like a silly little nitpick, but in the film version, they do something. They change something from the graphic novel. Let me put my fanboy hat on really quick.
Okay.
They change something.
This is one of the few times this ever happens for Nick.
Yeah. Right. The watch that he has to go back into the field generator to get in the film, they just change it to be in his watch. It's not his watch. In the graphic novel, he was fixing the watch for Janie. So I think that even though it's that tiny, tiny little bit, I think it's like, you've got to give that to him, you know? And I think they take that away from him a little bit, because the entire point of the character is, has he given up on humanity and has he lost his faith in humanity? And of course he hasn't, but that's the perception. And that's the perception that Adrian Veidt is desperately trying to sell. Mm-hmm. But I love Crudup in this film. And one of the most surprising things to me, when I read the graphic novel, I always imagined Manhattan having this large, larger than life kind of booming voice. And the fact that they kept it Crudup's very, very kind of mild mannered ish voice, very kind of meek and quiet voice, right, I think is a masterstroke. I think it's just like amazing. What do you think about that?
It kind of makes sense, because if you think about it, this character can see everything and he can do pretty much anything. Like, everything I complain about Superman with pales in comparison to what this character is able to do. Like, he is able to change matter at the drop of a hat. And having him be this all powerful thing, like, sure, you can imagine this giant booming voice, but really knocking it down and making him kind of soft spoken, pretty much monotone, makes sense, because if he has this big booming voice, then it feels like there's more importance put on everything that he's trying to say.
Oh, exactly.
But he's so above the level of everybody that he really doesn't need to command and have that command voice, the commanding voice that you would expect that kind of a character to have, because of just his sheer ability to do whatever he wants.
And I think one of the saddest things about the film is, I really don't think they ever kind of nail the way that Dr. Manhattan perceives times. He perceives all times simultaneously. So literally for him, everything is happening all at the same time. Like, he can live in one moment and then live in the next moment. And I think that Snyder tries, but I just don't think that the film ever really sells the way that he perceives time. So it just, the best scene probably is the scene on Mars where he says to Lori, he's like, in a moment, you're going to tell me, you know, you've been sleeping with Dan. And she's like, you know, I've been sleeping with Dan. And he's like, not yet. But then, like, a minute later, when she mentions it, he's like, you're sleeping with Dan. And she's like, but you already knew that. And that's probably, for me, the best instance in which they really are able to sell the way that that character perceives time, but I think that they really missed out on it. I think that the graphic novel goes so much more in depth into that character, and I really wish that the film would have captured that a little bit better.
Mm-hmm. I will say, in regards to Billy Crudup's performance, it is extremely hard to be as monotone as he is.
Yeah.
Michael Ansara, who was the original voice of Mr. Freeze back in the Batman and the animated series, I've heard stories of his work with the character, and if you hear how if you can remember how monotone that character
yeah.
was,
like
they would keep telling him after every take, okay, that's good, but we need less emotion and less emotion, less, like. For a lot of people and a lot of actors, it's extremely hard to, you know, kind of be emotionless. And for Billy Crudup to be able to pull that off in this kind of a role where, you know, you've seen everything, you see all the possibilities, you see everything at the same time. So you eventually over time become numb to everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, Billy Crudup is really able to sell that, especially with the way he is so soft spoken and so monotone, which, you know, those would sound like negatives. But in this kind of an instance with Dr. Manhattan and the power this character holds, it really, for me, enhances the way the character is.
And I mean, I think we have to talk about it because I know it's a sticking point for a lot of people that love the graphic novel and maybe weren't as hot on the film itself. And that's the change to the ending. In the ending of the graphic novel, Veidt's plan is basically to summon this giant alien squid fucking thing to New York, where it attacks and destroys New York. So then he brings peace by making Earth think that there's this alien threat that could descend upon them at any time. And in the film, this is changed to be Dr. Manhattan himself. And your take on that, because I have a definitive take on it, but I want to hear your take on whether or not you think that that's better or not and whether you think it works or not.
The squid sounds fucking stupid. That sounds so fucking dumb. Are you kidding me? Like, I kind of understand because I think back to Independence Day and the alien invasion there kind of unifying the whole planet, which we sort of kind of see in Independence Day Returgence, which will never be brought up again ever by anybody.
Thank you.
But that squid's just sounds so dumb. It sounds so fucking dumb.
I'll be honest with you.
Oh my God.
I'll be honest with you. It is dumb. It is because it's just this kind of really random out of left field thing. And I think the way that they paint the Manhattan character in this film is that he's losing touch with humanity. He's, you know, kind of doesn't care about humanity anymore. Think about the interview that he gives, the TV interview, where they ask him about somebody being dead and they're like, well, it's the same amount of cells, so what's the difference? You know,
right.
Like the idea of human life, or, you know, cherishing human life, to him is it's so beyond him at this point. Like, he is like so invested in everything else. So I think it makes perfect sense to transform that character and for Veidt to use that as his quote unquote weapon in the film, where, you know, he makes it look like Manhattan is attacked. And in the graphic novel, it was just New York. And I think in the film, they make it where this attack happens in a bunch of different cities all over the globe.
Yeah, it's like all the major cities, like New York, Paris, Moscow. London, Moscow, Hong Kong.
Like, so worldwide,
It's trying to unify, like, all the major powers at the time in the 80s, which I don't know why they thought France was a major power, but okay, whatever you want to say.
Oh, well.
It's like France is whatever, but like they're not America or England or Russia or China in this, like, during this time period. Come on.
Yeah. I love that they were able to take that and they were able to transform it into being Manhattan himself, because Manhattan leaves Earth at the end of the graphic novel and in the end of the film anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, by making it be like this omnipotent being, even though he's not really omnipotent, but to where they think that this omnipotent being is always watching and could come back at any time and just annihilate the shit out of them, That for me works as a better motive for peace than this really random out of fucking nowhere squid thing. That like, the squid thing is fucking weird, dude. The squid thing is really, really weird. And I love, like, fine, call the Dr. Manhattan machine the squid. That's like the acronym for whatever it is. And like when it activates, it has like these power tentacles that moves around. Like, I love that. That's a great nod to the graphic novel, but I love that they didn't go with that because it's absurd.
Well, right. And like you said, it feels like out of left field. Like it's not being teased at any moment. Like with Dr. Manhattan, you see a lot of cracks, especially like with the TV interview. Whenever he leaves in like a huff, it's like if I left a TV interview and could teleport, it would be like that. But yeah, like you kind of start to see the cracks in his character, and it would kind of make sense that Dr. Manhattan would just go absolutely nuts and just be like, well, fuck these cities in particular, and just, you know, use his energy to blow them up. Like, yeah. You know, that makes sense to me. A giant fucking squid that in no way is referenced until the very end of something makes no like it's
yeah, this squid it's like is throwing a really football. Fucking out of left field.
Yeah, it's like trying to throw a football into the stands as opposed to just throwing it downfield to the open receiver. Like, take the obvious path that you've created. Don't try to throw it to the fan who's just out like in the middle of like section 228 row J. Like, just take what you have and go.
Yeah, the squid was always a really, really weird element to me. So I did love that they changed that element of it. And I mean, I don't even fucking care about Silk Spectre 2 in the film because I think Malin Ackerman's performance is so bad. So many other actors around here are acting their asses off, and they're really embodying these characters so perfectly that her line delivery alone is cringe, like ultimate cringe. Mm-hmm. And I... God in heaven. Look, and you get Carla Gugino in this film to be the original Silk Spectre, and God, they make her look beautiful. But there's a couple other things I want to touch on with this before we wrap up here tonight, Dan.
Mm-hmm.
The first of those being the opening of this film. And in the graphic novel, there's like, I think it's like an entire chapter, I can't remember, like one entire volume of the graphic novel is devoted to the Minutemen and like the backstory of this whole world before the present day, of like what masked heroes were beforehand. And they basically take Bob Dylan's The Times They Are A-Changin' and they cut all this stuff into it, and they make it work within a 5-minute time frame. It's still one of my favorite openings to a film, period, because it's got that perfect Snyder slow-mo, and it perfectly explains and perfectly sets the stage for the world in which this entire film is about to take place. What were your thoughts on like the opening of the film? Like, after, of course, the comedian gets killed, just that entire opening credits montage.
Right. So, It's interesting because, like, for the most part, the scenes are practically still images. Like, they'll like be not hyper zoomed in, but they'll be zoomed in and then they'll slowly zoom out. Right. And I guess slow mo does happen, but like in reality, like what actually happens in the scene doesn't matter. What really matters is the snapshot that you're taking. So. Yep. Like whenever they're taking the photo of the original Night Owl with the guy in a headlock who's firing off the gun doesn't matter. It's that Night Owl has apprehended somebody, and the
great thing about that is that it's meant to be Batman. Like, they're meant to be outside of the theater, the Monarch Theater, whatever it is, whatever theater Batman's parents got shot out in front of, because you see them in the background of that shot too. Where, you know, because of the Night Owl, like, Batman never had to happen.
Oh, okay. That's cool. Yeah. Which I guess for comic people right now, there's apparently an arc going on about the Watchmen crossing over into the current DC universe. So
yeah, I think that was Rebirth or whatever.
Yeah.
I think so.
Batman found the comedian badge.
Yeah.
Which is cool. I haven't read anything about that, but that is always cool. But, like... So with that, it's not what's actually happening. It's how it's staged and how, like, what's staged in the photograph as opposed to, you know, what like what slow-mo is going on. Like, you could have gotten away with not even having the slow-mo. It could have just been still images that you zoomed out from. I thought that I think it's a really cool intro. I think it's a very cool intro, and you know, really sets the stage for this next generation of quote-unquote heroes.
Yeah, I think it's pretty much note perfect. And I mean, overall, we talked about the Black Freighter stuff a little bit earlier, but we haven't really touched on Matthew Good or his performance as Ozymandias. But I'll be honest, I just don't think he gets enough to do. I really, really don't. I mean, I don't think he's bad in the role. A lot of people like to give him shit. But I mean, he even in the director's cut, Ozymandias maybe has like 5 minutes of screen time. Like, at the end of the film, like, he probably gets more screen time in the confrontation at Karnak in Antarctica than he does in the entire rest of the film combined. And that's sad. That's sad because we're meant to understand how much this means to that character that he did this. And you get so little of him. You get so little of that throughout the entire film. I think that's so sad.
Yeah, I agree. That character had potential to be so much more. Like, he could have been so much more influential on the world, if you just would have let him, you know, do things. But they don't let him do anything, you know, and he kind of winds up being this modern villain of superhero movies, where it's just like, hey, we're just going to kind of toss you in here, and you're just going to kind of exist. Like yes, you've shown that you care about people and the world and the greater good, but, you know, we don't get to see anything about you until the very end of the movie, where, you know, he does wind up kicking a lot of ass. But at that point, it's almost too late for the character.
I do love that the way that they designed the costuming in this film, too, to where Ozymandias' costume was meant to be a parody of the, like, the late 90s, especially the Batman Forever, Batman and Robin type suit, like rubber with the molded nipples and everything. I love that that was meant to be like kind of a spoof on that. I do love that. I love Night Owl's costume work in the film. I love all the costume work in this film, to be 100% honest. I think it's absolutely fantastic.
Right.
And it really, really makes these characters look vibrant. But to go back to Adrian for just a moment, I mean, in the graphic novel, he's like the world's strongest man. He's like the most physically fit person on the planet. He's the smartest man in the world. He's fast enough to catch a bullet. Like, he is like the peak of human physicality. He's basically... think of how many of these different heroes in this film represent some aspect of Batman if you just combine them all. You know what I mean? And that's right. What Ozymandias is supposed to be. And sadly, you don't get any of that in this film, except for like that one ham-fisted, like, I hate the shot of him catching the bullet at the end of the film. It's so stupid.
Why wouldn't she just shoot
him in the fucking head? Like, seriously.
It's so bad.
She's like point-blank range and she wouldn't just shoot him in the head. Like, get the fuck out of here. That's what that character is supposed to be. And unfortunately, they just eviscerated most of his plot from the film. And it's such a disservice, because the fact that he's come to this conclusion, the fact that he's come to this fact that he has to kill millions of people and form peace based on a lie, as Night Owl says to him, I think that to get a character to that place, to get a character to that kind of place in life, it's so important and it's so poignant, and I think it's such a disservice that they completely gloss over the whole fucking thing in the film. Like, you never get any inkling of that at all in the film. Like, I think it really needs to get to that point, and I think it really needs to, I don't know, I really, really feel like it needs to do a lot more to kind of sell that, because you do, especially in the director's cut, you get scenes of the world's shittiest Nixon impersonator with Henry Kissinger.
This is so bad. It's so bad. That, like, that's all I can think of when I see the Nixon impersonator. It's just like, holy shit, this nose is terrible.
Yeah, and I mean, they really wanted to make it look like really cartoonish, and I get that, but like, I think that there's a lot more that you could have done to really elevate the stakes of this and really kind of make the stakes of this and the reasoning that Ozymandias would come to this kind of decision. I really think that you could have sold that a lot better. And I just don't think they do it in this film.
And I hate to keep rehashing it, but like, giving him maybe 10 minutes of screen time in total, and five of it is at the end of the movie, is not how you want to do.
Oh, no, like, not
it's not how you do justice to your main antagonist. And,
no.
And it's do you actually feel like he's an antagonist? But still, like, if he's going to be the reason the heroes all come together at the end, you can't give him such little development as he had throughout the movie. You just can't.
Yeah. But yeah, I don't have anything else to really mention about the film, Dan. But it is one of my favorite films. I do really, really enjoy the film. I'd probably peg like an 8 out of 10 on it or something like that if I really had it, especially the director's cut. You know, but I mean, yeah, there definitely are flaws there. And I mean, especially in terms of an adaptation of the graphic novel, it took the monumental task of trying to adapt this graphic novel into something that I think was digestible. And I think for the most part, Snyder is extremely successful. Like I said, in terms of adaptations, just in terms of panel to screen, there are a ton of just literally perfect shots that are just perfectly transposed right over from the film. And I think that's such a credit to Snyder. And I think it's such a credit to the entire production on this film that they were able to take Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons' work and make it, number one, look as good as it does, and that they were able to condense as much of the story into this film as they were. As we were saying up at the top of everything, I really feel like this would have been better served as a 2-part film. Like, if you could have done this in 5 hours, I think it would have been perfect, because you could have gotten much more into Laurie's character, much more into Ozzy's character. But as it stands, I mean, it's a flawed, it's an imperfect adaptation of a great graphic novel that, you know, I think people are warmer on it now than they were around when it was released, but even still, I do still love it.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I've seen the movie. I pretty much saw it opening weekend in 2009, so it's been, what, 8 years now since I've seen this movie. It was nice to go back and revisit it. I can't even remember what spurred on me wanting to go watch it. I think we were talking about it in the Podfix chat that something about Watchmen, and I just went, oh yeah, I want to watch that again. So let's do a spotlight on it. But I did want to mention that I feel like this movie and this subject matter and this, you know, this comic book, this graphic novel, really falls more in Zack Snyder's wheelhouse than what we got of Superman and Batman versus Superman. Like, I'm sorry, Man of Steel and Batman versus Superman. I do like both of those movies, but this, especially for Snyder's visual style and how he likes to wash out colors, it really fit more tonally with this subject matter than it does with what his work is in the DCEU right now.
You know, one of my favorite things they did in this film was for Manhattan, they had Billy Crudup on set the entire time in a mocap suit that was basically adorned with like thousands of blue Christmas lights. I mean, it wasn't Venuses. That crude. They were built into the suit, but like that glow that you see off of that character the entire time, that's real. Like, that was really on set. And I love the way that you see that light reflecting off of everything whenever he's in a scene. There are little attentions to detail. There are little touches like that to this film that are what elevate it for me from being just so, okay, this was all right, this was fine or whatever, to perfect. And I think you can almost watch this film, Dan, and you can almost point out which characters the production, like the screenwriters and Snyder, really, really love versus those they were like, okay, they're essential to the story, but meh. The comedian, definitely, Rorschach, definitely, Night Owl, definitely, and Manhattan, I think, are the top four that they really get perfectly right. And I think, like I said, I think you just needed to spend more time with Ozzy. I don't necessarily think Matthew Good was bad, but Jesus fucking Christ. Malin Ackerman should have been nowhere near this movie, like by 1,000 miles. She looks the part. I'll definitely give her that. She absolutely looks the part, and she looks fantastic in that Silk Spectre 2 costume. Let's not take that away. But she can't deliver dialogue to save her fucking life.
Right. Like the scene with her on Mars, like it's supposed to be this super poignant moment for this character. And upon watching it again, you know, actually watching for the performance, I'm just like, man, this just isn't hitting. Like, this doesn't hit as hard as it needs to, because she's just not convincing enough with her delivery.
Yeah. Now, God damn it, I hate her character so much. And I love that character in the graphic novel, too, which it really, really is a disservice to how great that character is in the graphic novel that she played it, that she did portray that character in this film. I just, God damn it. Such a missed opportunity, such a wasted opportunity as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. But any final thoughts you want to throw in here before we wrap it up, Dan?
Just really quick, I love Rorschach's mask during this. I the parts I have read of the Watchmen graphic novel, I do know that his mask changes around, and I really feel like that is the best work with CGI in this movie, is watching Rorschach's mask change around from just standing there to like walking around to still seeing it change around. I think it's some of the best visual work you'll see in the movie.
I mean, we didn't mention it the entire time in the film, but how did you feel about swinging blue dongs?
I do have to wonder if that is actually Billy Crudup's penis. Like, if that's his penis size. That's a shame. I hope
actually. There were, like, a lot of discussions about what the penis should look like and, like, how big it should be and all that different stuff. Like, I mean, I forget who it was. It was some bodybuilder that they modeled the actual Manhattan character off of, because Billy Crudup does not fucking look like that. They took some bodybuilder.
Wait,
and sculpted
you're telling
it.
Me he's not entirely blue?
Sorry, Dan.
Damn. Yeah,
they took some bodybuilder. It was some bodybuilder's body that they modeled the Manhattan character off of. But yeah, I do remember reading that they had numerous conversations about how big the penis should be and like what it should do, because he's supposed to represent like this idealization of, you know, the male anatomy.
What I would have liked to see in the movie is that, like, at the beginning,
his
whenever
dick
he
his
fully
knees?
Forms,
come on, Dan.
Right. No, exactly. I want him to have like this incomprehensibly large penis at the beginning, like the quote unquote beginning of his arc. And then, like, as he slowly realizes that he has a greater purpose, he devotes less and less to the size of his penis. I feel like that would have been a nice touch.
He just shrinks it down, like, periodically, like, as he goes.
Exactly. I would have loved that. That would have been the perfect touch for the character.
Oh, that would have been perfect. Oh, I love you so much. Oh, God. But, yeah, there it is. So, spotlight for Watchmen. I know that was a very kind of unfocused and meandering discussion about a lot of the characters and a lot of the themes in the film, but that's the way the film is itself. It's very meandering and it's very mm-hmm. unfocused, but that's also, frankly, the way that the graphic novel is. It devotes entire chapters to backstory for characters where you're not focusing on the main plot at first. Mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, I do love it. That's one of the reasons I do love it. I love it as an adaptation. I love it as a film on its own. I just wish they had gone the route of doing like a two-parter, like a 5-hour long, two-part just extravaganza where you're right. It would have been perfect. Have Rorschach be unmasked. And then mm-hmm. second half of the film is all the second half of the film stuff. I think it would have been fantastic.
Yeah, and you open back up with Rorschach getting questioned in the in the prison. I feel like that would have been very nice.
All right, so Dan, I'm not going to let you tell our audience where they can find you, because they've heard you on this show a million times and they know all about the Netflix and Soul podcast, or at least
do they?
They should.
Well, either that, or they willfully ignore the fact that I'm even on this show anymore.
No, I don't think they do. But please check both of us out and all the other amazing shows that are part of the Podfix Network, especially if you're watching this on video. You can see across the top and across the bottom of the screen all the amazing shows that call the Podfix Network home. Thank you all very, very much for watching. Thank you all very, very much for listening. And I'm going to go get Chipotle, Dan, so I can record my next episode of The Restaurant.
Woo! I'm very proud of you.
And we'll see you at the movies.
This was a podcast from the Podfix Network. You can check out more shows like it at podfixnetwork.com.
We'll see you at the movies. Dot, dot, dot.
Next Tuesday.
Next Tuesday. I didn't even push it once the whole night.
I sucked a dick last night.
There he is.
Oh, that reminds me really quick. Fuck off, Justin.
Perfect. Coming to a soundboard near you.